And we will stay in Romania with your presentation, Alina. Yeah, it's here. So I will say a few words of introduction since the time we find the slideshow. So you work at the Carroll Museum in Brăila, and in the eastern part of Romania. And next to your activity of curating, you are writing a PhD about socialist realism in Romania in the 50s, but also in the 60s and the 70s, with all the question of socialist modernism and what we can, very interesting topic, what we can understand by that. And also important notion for us in the 50s, the question of regionalism, which is quite important in every country. And you will present a very important topic, and we are really happy that you introduce this notion, the representation of the minority, the national minorities in... That's a text. In the socialist realism of the 50s. That's one topic that we didn't expect and that came progressively. Okay, so it's totally new for us. So in terms of plan, the time we find back the images. It is really unfair for you, Alina, because you send it so early and so. maybe we will have the discussion about Chandor and Irina presentations, and then we'll do the coffee break. And Alina, you will do your presentation after the coffee break. Chandor and Irina, can you come? And yeah, I guess it will take some time. Yeah, can you come? Sorry. Is there questions about the two presentations? No, no, no. Oh, yes. Yes, you're in architecture.
Maybe I can open up with a question regarding the last presentation, the one regarding the Romanian settlement and the, let's say, the integration of, and the study of folk architecture and the creation of this garden city as a model of workers' town. I mean, I've been investigating with my office, like what happened in Warsaw and like in Poland regarding this regionalism or introduction of like folk the solutions into urban architecture, and I was wondering if you could maybe expand on how architecture complied with sort of like this social engineering in terms of transforming a peasant into an urbanite in a sense, because like somehow we observed that in Warsaw there were like devices like took directly from studies of countryside architecture by Zofia and Oskar Hansen, so they introduced in workers' urban settlement, typical traditional elements of the attributes of the social space that there would be in Polish countrysides. So if you could maybe expand on these devices, like somehow that would actually ease the transformation through architectural form, rather than maybe in the language of architecture, if there was such a thing.
Well, actually, this transfer has the key in, as I was saying previously, in the previous period, in between 40 and 42, because it was also a state initiative in order to create, at that time they were called, again, the same word, popular dwellings for workers, but at the time it was the term. It was popular in the sense of cheap or affordable dwellings for workers, And it was a group of architects that made a very intense study, studying different kind of housing in all the Europe, all over the Europe. It wasn't a particular site. It was in the Italian case. I think it was also, they were searching also the Hungarian case. It doesn't matter exactly what they were, the examples that were they were taking into consideration. And also they were taking into consideration Romanian case studies, industries that created housing for workers. And practically the conclusion of that study was emphasizing that the Romanian population, rural population, that is going from the villages to the new urban industrial towns at that moment, was not yet prepared to live in collective houses. So the conclusion was that after the war, it will end because it was in the middle of the war and it was a plan for the reconstruction. After the war will end, we will construct mainly this type of housing in garden cities and as experiments, some blocks of flats. And we will see afterwards. And actually, practically, the example of Hunedoara is practically the first example that was somehow prepared before the war, but it was at the incidence of the socialist thinking somehow. And I think that this transfer is also made because there were professionals that were beginning their work in during the interwar period, but actually the architects that worked for the new housing, the new blocks of flats, they were very young architects that graduated in 48 or 52. So imagine a young, I don't know, a young a young architect that 23 years old, 24, let's say, because probably they were older because of the war, to put into, and probably a believer, a socialist believer, to put all this in into practice. And it is true that the work of these of some of these architects, the later work of these architects from the mid-60s, proves that they mixed again, they tried to have a hybrid, let's say, because this concept was also used these days, a hybrid architecture between this kind of folk architecture and modernist architecture. But it's not that there were discussions between rural and urban inside the architects group and separating rural from urban, but it was in the interwar period. It wasn't, there weren't the same discussion after the 50s.
Just a quick question. Did they borrow from, did they look at examples of those new cities outside Romania? Because when I looked at this first plan of the garden city with those small villas, you know, the example of Žlin, in Czechoslovakia comes to mind because that was a city which was built of those tiny but still in private houses. So I wonder whether that could be, or perhaps they had some other models.
Yes, at that moment that they really were connected and articles were published about everything that was happening into Europe. It was that phase of transition from, let's say, the liberal profession of architects in stages to the I don't know, institutionalized profession of the architects. But at that moment, they were very conscious of what was happening all over the Europe.
It was private, of course.
Yes.
It was
Yes, but that's what I was saying, that in the interwar period they were researching on that matter. So they had already connections with in the entire, they were visiting the sites. So they were really connected with different architects and different...
Shonda, I have a question. What is the difference between the civilized workers, what was the goal, and the petit, what you call the petit bourgeois workers from the late 50s? How do we draw the line?
So thank you for the question. I have to think about it. at the moment, I don't know. But so I think that these are belonging to different discourses. So the petit bourgeois burghers discourse was very widespread in the public discourses, and I think that it was mainly about the traditions and the pre-war traditions, and not about the workers, the civilization, and this which is belonging also to the discourse regarding the Kulturnostjetzon. I think is another one, and the civilization and the civilized worker is somehow more interconnected to the ideal socialist man. So, and probably in the representations, it can be also a different one, but I don't know exactly. So, this because it's coming from different different fields. So, so that the petit bourgeois thing is always in the focus when anti-consumptional or anti-traditional discourse is emerging. The civilized and anti-civilized workers is mainly in the discourses regarding the working class. So.
Perhaps I would like to add something to your question. And okay, you said that in that era they were still very liberal and they already had these connections with all European colleagues and other projects and so on. But this garden city started at the beginning of the 20th century. And it was, I mean, they had this concept of humanizing also the living of community and also this ecological concepts of how to live together. I mean, you can see this in a lot of garden cities in Germany, in Hellerau and also in Frohnau next to Berlin. And I was wondering if it was also an attempt to relink with this kind of modern ideas and concepts, because it was still this liberal era before they really institutionalized the position of an architect, and if it was also an attempt to relink with this pre-war humanistic ideas of living, or if it was only this idea of, okay, they are peasants, so we have to give them a garden.
Thank you for the question, let's say, or not for, for the things that you have had. In fact, it's not... It's very difficult to understand exactly what were the thoughts of the architects, because, of course, they were still, let's say, liberal. But actually, the texts of that period are not quite out of the out of the ideology, and you cannot split the things, as I was saying, that the architects believed from the things that they had, that they think that they have to write. Because it was the beginning of the propaganda. So probably they were looking to, let's say, to the West, but they were writing that it is a socialist key of the model. So
yes, I understand. That's why I was wondering if they used also this kind of model, because they could link the socialist ideas and ideology to this kind of humanistic models and ecological models, because this would fit in a certain way also in this kind of very rigid and sometimes dogmatic socialist way of how to consider what community housing would look like, so that they really linked or retook those ideas because it would fit within this perhaps dogmatic.
It was a part of it, but also it was a part of the thinking of the 40s that was kind of different from these ideas, because it was the part, a period, the 40s actually in Romania, 40, 42, it was a period also of constraint, and it was a period of domination of the right wing at the time. And it was also that there were also ideas that educating through housing, so they were not really directly related, I would say, with this idea, necessarily to this idea of humanizing. Each of the architects had his relations, his texts, his readings. So it was not a general idea, a general opinion, let's say, formulated.
Other question, remark? No. It's not a question, but more a comment. At one point, when you spoke about the difference between countryside and city, you said the two nations, it was so different that it is practically two nations. Is it... What question? In Hungary, but also in other countries, is it really in the 50s the gap is so large that the countryside and the city were considered as really two totally different worlds?
Of course not, and it wasn't so wide for hundreds of years. So the main cities were developed according to the massive immigration. So biggest cities in Europe were always immigrant cities. So most of the people who were living there, and because of the industrialization, were coming from the countryside. But this sharp contrast, as I stated, was created mostly by the officials and in official discourse, and this was also present in some Western countries, and the main reason for it was that they had to find somebody who can be blamed because of the failures of the industrialization, and it was easier to find the strangers in the city because this old and new workers, between to draw the line between the old and new workers. It was also easy to draw the line between the old citizens and who were living in the city, and between the newcomers who were infiltrated into each of the cities, not only in Eastern Europe but in the Western as well. So for your question, it wasn't so, but it was represented as a big difference. And it started especially in the middle of the 50s in the local discourses around Eastern Europe, and that was partially an outcome of the de-Stalinization campaign.
Also for Sandor, there is a debate in the literature on communism as to whether there is such a thing as a communist welfare state. Espen Andersson did have such a tentative category, but then well, this was discussed by other people, including the Hungarian historian Bela Tomka. So what is your position on this, and based on your empirical research?
So that's why I put it with a question mark, this welfare communists. So the problem is that there were no real unions in Eastern Europe who were acting against the owners of the factories, and that is the and owners of each of the land, and that's why the so-called citizenry and the so-called civic societies wasn't existing. So this is more or less the on the opposite side, that we can talk about a welfare, real welfare state, where the people can somehow represent their wishes. But from the other point of view, the paternalistic state wanted to represent itself as it seems to be a welfare state, and for some social groups, through different practices, it became possible to represent their wishes. For example, as it comes out from the 60s and 70s sociological research, many people in the new housing estates were coming from the groups of the intelligentsia. And that was because of that the intelligentsia could achieve the goal to receive an apartment in the cities. And for example, from this point of view, this new cadres, and we can also define the intelligentsia in a broad way, that we state, for example, that the new cadres and the new bureaucracy was belonging to this kind of group as a apparatus of the state could achieve their goals. And not only by demonstrations or strikes, but, as I told, different representations of themselves according to the wishes of the local bureaucracy. And so my position is between somehow that it's so the Western welfare state models cannot be applied, of course, to the Eastern West. But we can use some of the outcomes of the research made already on the welfare state. And this was, for example, the statement of Gösta Espeng Andersen, which is very well resonated with researchers and sociologists, researchers who made about which groups could benefit from the unbalanced redistribution system of the socialist state. And I think that this model can be used further, and somehow it can help to understand, for example, in that reason, that why socialism could be stable for so long, and not only because of the Soviet tanks, but because of the local societies who were not every day going for demonstrations, as we know.
Thank you.
My name is Gzel, Sławomir Gzel. I'm working at Technical University in Warsaw as an architect. I have one remark. Not each group of housing with big number of trees, it is Garden City, of course. It is just group of housing or city with big number of trees, so I couldn't agree to name to give this name to some of examples that were shown here. This is one thing. The other one, I'm curious how it is, how it was in different countries, because in Poland we observed in those years, in the beginning of in years after the war, kind of duality in life, something different in work, in school, at university, and something different home. I remember, because, well, I could say that I'm a witness of those epoch, and I remember that in school we talk about, we have books about Pavka Morozov, who was hero of, in Soviet Russia, but in home we have completely different heroes. And this duality wasn't just after the war. It was, in fact, to the end of the socialist period in Poland, to the 90s. Different in work, different home, different, as I said, university, school, and so on. I'm interested how it was in your countries. Okay? Could I have such an answer?
I'll let you answer.
I will start about the first your first remark. Probably yes, not every range of houses with gardens and trees can be called a garden city, but in fact the architects at the time was calling it this way. It was not me that I am calling it like this. So they were positioning themselves in this in relation with the garden city. On the other hand, this double vision, of course, of this double life, actually, it is something that, at least for Romania, it's something that lasts until 89 and probably even in the 90s. And of course, this goes also, this is something very important because it is related to the fact that everything that we know about all the period that passed, all the communist, let's say, period, we know it only from the written texts, published texts, official texts, and it seems, and we know, that there is another, there are another proofs of what happened, of how the everyday life was at the time. But since we don't have really oral archives, probably it will be lost forever.
Want to add something?
Yes. So, of course, in every country, this double speech is coming originally, I think, already from Orwell. So what we how we talk differently at home in the private space and the public sphere, but and this is also described in the totalitarian paradigm very clearly by many authors, and of course in each of the countries of the socialist regime, and nowadays probably in China and many countries we can recognize this difference in the public speech and in the private speech. But I would recommend the book of, for example, Alexei Jurchak, who described this from a different point of view in the Soviet Union, how this double speech was used also as a, not only as a way of opposite thinking, but also as a way that how, for example, people were laughing on the public speeches and how the irony destroyed the regime itself. And I think that this is very important to understand the slight differences between these countries as well, and probably this is one goal of this conference as well, organized by Jerome and Joanna, and thank you for organizing this event, that in each of these countries, we had different taboos. For example, in Hungary, we couldn't, so the families couldn't talk openly about 1956. This was the main taboo, and the main events around the transformation of the regime were attached to if can we talk about 1956 or not. So even jokes were created ending with 1956. It was so it was so big taboo that in Hungary there were several jokes in created from algebra or mathematics. When it ended with 1956, nobody told it, but everybody was laughing it because it was somehow a joke that cannot talk about what happened really in 1956. And this was how also many people who represented Hungary as the funniest barrack in Eastern Europe were serving not to speak about that the regime itself in the beginning in the 50s was established on the terror at the end of the revolt against the Soviet regime. And probably in other countries like the normalization in Czech Republic or the solidarity movements and the cruelties in Poland as well belong to the taboos. But if we think that this double speech between the public and private, there were no walls. There was only a very strict wall, and people started to walk, started to talk differently at home than public, and vice versa. I think it's not true. So we have to understand also that what came from the public sphere to the private and what from the private to the public, because it's this dichotomy is something like the rural and urban life, which were always attached together and they were always interconnected. So people in the rural sphere since the industrial revolution are living from city products and vice versa as well. So people in the public space cannot talk totally differently than in the private and vice versa.
Okay, thank you very much, and we will have a coffee break, very short. I would say, 10 minutes, very until 45, and then we have. Okay, thanks, and thank you again to the two.